Okay, we can start. Hello.
Yay.
Hi.
Welcome back to our episode 12. This episode, our topic, I guess, broad topic is mental health. And we have a special guest with us. Her name is Irene. She's super cool.
Hi.
And I guess you will introduce her. She'll introduce herself in a bit, but we will do our normal check-in and see how everyone is doing. How is everyone doing? How's everyone feeling today?
Pretty good. Weather's really nice, so that's good.
Love that. Do you also get because I get huge, what is it called? Seasonal depression? Like if it's just such bad weather outside, I can't get out of bed to do anything.
Really? I like it. I like the cold weather. I think because this is super psychological, but I feel like when the weather is bad, it makes you feel like there's no pressure to go out. So you get to just feel like you could stay home and be comfortable and nurture yourself. So
I love that. Yeah.
I used to feel more depressed, I guess, during summer season because I'm it's really nice weather. I feel like I should be going out. So that would make me feel anxious. But now I feel like I could enjoy both or all the weathers.
Wow, I love that.
yeah. That's so interesting because I feel like I'm the opposite. When it's overcast and it's always, if you've been to SF, you know, it's always so windy and always foggy. And when it's that weather, I'll get really unmotivated and sad. But yeah, overall, I think I'm doing good. Yeah, honestly, just been taking online classes. That's it.
Same. I've been, what have I been doing? I've just been it's been really weird. I've had, very anxious week because I haven't been able to use the bathroom. I haven't been able to poop. It's just really weird. And I'm just trying to be, patient with my body and, let it be. But yeah, other than that, what else have I been doing? I have been getting back into photography. I did a shoot with a few friends. So I've been editing those and posting those. And it's been really fun to be creative again because I feel like I lost touch with that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Even though this podcast is very creative too. But I think photography is just, it's different. But yeah. Yeah, pretty average week so far, I would say.
Yeah, should we get into our little question for today?
Yes, let's
all
do
right.
It.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so our question for this episode is, what is your favorite spot or favorite thing to do in the Bay Area? Because Irene is also from the Bay Area.
I would say overall, just eating. I feel like whenever you have free time here, you just go on Yelp, look for a restaurant. I think TikTok too has been very helpful in that as well, just so many food TikToks. And so anytime I do have free time and you just want to go do something quick, I feel like it's easy to go eat somewhere and try their food. But other than that, I do like to camp a lot and go out on hikes. So I guess we're lucky in that sense too, because we have Yosemite, Lake Tahoe, just so many different, camping spots near here.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's cool.
Do you have
any
favorite?
Yeah, I was gonna
favorite
ask.
Restaurant.
Oh boy, I really don't know because there's so many different types of food here.
Yeah.
But I guess if I were to pick something that I really like, there's this udon place in Mountain View. And it's, the best udon I've ever had. I think it's udon mugiso or something like that. But it's so good.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. I'm coming to the Bay, mid-July. So hopefully I'll go try it out. That sounds so good. I love udon. What's your favorite place, Summer, since you're also in the Bay?
I'll talk about a place. I think since I'm in SF right now, and one of my favorite places is actually the Golden Gate Park. I love the Golden Gate Park. It's nice to have this big of a park in the city, I feel like. And also, like, just the greenery and, like, the flowers are so beautiful during spring and summer. And I like going on walks, and sometimes I go on a run with my dad there.
Aww.
It's a good spot to take pictures, too.
Aww.
Well, mm-hmm. I need to go.
Yes. When you come down, I'll bring you.
Yes. Okay. So, well, obviously, Irene is here. And we actually met Irene. This is funny because we were, like, so usually on our Instagram page, we do, like, a TikTok feature Friday thing where we just wanted to, like, really feature API creators on our Instagram page. And then we reposted one of Irene's TikToks, and she responded. I think we usually, when we post people's TikToks, we don't expect people to respond because we're like, I don't know. It's just like people usually just like it and then like whatever. Mm-hmm. But Irene responded, and you were like very engaging. Like, you're asking us questions, and we had like a whole conversation on there. And so, yeah, that's how we met, like a week ago. And yeah, you were just like so willing to be on our podcast, and I was like, this is so cool. But that is how we met, and I guess you can introduce yourself so our audience can get to know you and like a little bit of your background.
Mm-hmm. So I'm Irene. I was born and raised here in the Bay Area. I went to art school for 4 years, and I studied fine art photography. And during that time, I took a lot of, like, I focused on portraiture and specifically like nude portraiture, just because I felt like very drawn to the concept of capturing people nude and like empowering them in such a vulnerable state. And also for me personally, like, you know, being able to connect with someone while they're in such a vulnerable state is like such a beautiful connection, because I feel like a lot of people see their naked body as something that is very unprotected. And therefore, in order to show that to someone, you have to have a lot of, you know, trust there. And so when I started nude photography, I only took photos of females, because for me it was very empowering, but also just like, you know, taking sexuality away from the nude body was like something I really wanted to explore. And as like the years went by and I was continuing nude photography, I realized I felt so drawn to it, because like I had remembered during college like a memory of being sexually assaulted as a child. And so I realized that this whole project that I was exploring and, you know, taking new photography was a lot deeper than I thought it was. And it was almost like a healing process for me. And like for me to explore, you know, what this meant, like being nude and like not being sexualized or objectified, but also like having trust with people. And also like I started to branch out into photographing nude men, which was like a whole nother, you know, like topic. I felt like that was very hard for me to do because it was very triggering, but I felt like it was something I needed to do for myself and also just for my work, because my professors and my peers were kind of like, oh, you take so many nudes of women, but like, how about men? Like, do you want to explore that? And I resonated with it at that time. And I was like, no, yeah, I think that is something I would want to explore. So I took some nude photographs of men, and I feel like I try to capture them in the more feminine, vulnerable, you know, way that you don't normally see men depicted. And so that was very, it was like very nice for me to explore that as well. And also just like for my own healing journey to foster this sense of trust between men. Cause like at that time I was very just like, I was so scared of like any man. Like at that point in my life, I was, you know, having panic attacks every day. Just like if a man got close to me, or if I was on BART and a man sat next to me on BART, just very scared and very like, I would have this like visceral reaction to it of like, I don't know if this person is going to like, you know, hurt me in any sort of way. So Yeah, I graduated college, and for a few years, I tried to look for photography-related jobs, but nothing really resonated with me, especially in the Bay Area, because, like, it's so many tech jobs. So, like, the only photo-related jobs out here were just, like, you know, taking product photos or photo editing. Also, just, like, you could freelance photograph for, like, people, I guess, like, taking portraits of them, wedding photography, all that stuff. And none of those things really resonated with me. So, because I was doing fine art for so many years in college, and nothing was, like, creatively stimulating for me. And I didn't want to, like, settle for an editing job and just be sitting in front of the computer for 8 hours a day, commuting back and forth and just, like, suffering through that. So I kind of, like, delved into the realm of behavioral therapy. So I got certified as a RBT, which is, like, a whole different thing. And that's a registered behavioral technician. I don't know if you guys have heard about that.
I think no, I so. I think I was, like, looking at jobs related to that, too.
Okay, yeah. Basically, I would be working with, like, autistic kids and, like, having, like, intervention on behavior patterns that are not necessarily, like, healthy. And also, like, teaching them behavior patterns and ways to take care of themselves. And so I was really into that for, like, a year. But quarantine and COVID, they all hit. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I was unemployed during COVID because with RBT, you would have to be working, like, hands-on with kids, and that wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. So I kind of started shifting into the realm of, like, coaching, because I felt like with the knowledge of my, you know, RBT, and, like, I started to really think, like, I could apply this to people. And I kind of was, like, in my personal life, I'm very much so that friend you go to when you're really going through something. And I'm not, like, the type to just listen, but I'm just, like, you're feeling like this because it's linked to this event that happened in your life. So you have to do this in order to improve from here on out. And I felt like this would happen a lot. And a lot of my friends would say, have you ever thought about being a therapist? Like, all these things. And I'm like, no, like, I don't want to go back to school. And then I, like, really started researching so deeply every single day on, like, psychology and all that stuff. And then I came across, like, coaching. And I actually watched this interview of this ADHD coach, and he was talking about his job. And it really just, like, sparked an idea in me that, like, really resonated to, like, my core. There's really this gap with women who do want to seek help with, you know, not processing their trauma, but to, like, to learn different ways of reprogramming your brain and reparenting yourself. Because, like, with therapy, therapy is very much so about processing your past and your trauma. And I feel like a lot of women, especially when you're, like, getting older, like, around 25 and up, you start to hit a point where you're like, I don't need to go to therapy and talk about these things over and over again. I just want to know what to do. And I found a lot of my friends around the same age were struggling with that same, you know, thought of, like, I just want someone to tell me what to do and, like, how I could, you know, start dating again after an abusive relationship, things like that. And I was like, I want to be able to bridge that gap for people and help people out there who want to know what to do about their trauma and not just, like, sit there and be sad and process that. And, like, you know, very much so, like, action-oriented growth type of a thing. And so that's when I started, like, I dove in deep, like, headfirst, and I, like, created my website. I started making TikToks. And just, like, creating content that, like, really resonated with me. And I felt like I've gotten a lot of good feedback from that I was not expecting at all. Like, for me, it was just expressing myself, but I feel like a lot of people were able to resonate. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm a self-empowerment coach based in the Bay Area. I help women who have gone through some form of abuse in the past with either family, relationships, work environment, or all of the above, and they need help to reparent themselves and reprogram their brains in order to function to their fullest capacity and therefore like reach their full potential and not feel like they're approaching life with lack mentality.
That's actually so cool. And I agree with what you said because when I first came, I was the one who sent that TikTok to Crystal to like post on our story. And when I first like watched a TikTok, I think it was about how, I think it was about intergenerational trauma within like Asian families. And I think that just really resonated with me. And I think you put some of the feelings that I'm feeling, but I couldn't find a word to express it, but you were able to like articulate it very well.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything specifically that like resonated with you?
I think you talk about something like about being first generation and how, you know, a lot of the times we feel like our parents sacrificed so much for us to be here to get better education, a better future. But then at the same time, like we also have to draw the boundaries for ourselves, like to what extent can we respect our parents while drawing our own boundaries? I think that was a very important point that I got from your TikTok.
Yeah,
I think I talked to you about this on like when we were texting on Instagram, but I think before I heard or watched that TikTok, I was like, the only way I thought about seeing how I like the respect I had for my parents was like, I guess respect, and like the only feeling I had was guilt when it comes to respecting my parents' wishes and doing whatever, you know, they wanted me to do and having them, you know, sacrifice so much for me to come to the US for high school and college and stuff. And so I never really I never really let myself feel that I could do what I wanted to do. And I think that like watching that TikTok really helped me understand that more. And I think I always like knew that, you know, I should be able to live my own life, but I never could put it into words. And so I think watching that, it was like a light bulb moment for me. And I was like, okay, like yes, they love me. And you know, they've only wanted the best for me, but simultaneously I can also be in control of like what I want to do with my life. It's just like a lot of feelings that I think we grew up with and we don't really know how to see it from a different kind of point of view. Mm-hmm. So I think like just one TikTok that I saw from you talking about that like really helped. So I'm sure everyone who like watches your TikToks can relate as well. Yeah, so I guess you like talked about how you started self-empowerment. And also we know that you're first generation, and I guess we can all like talk about this too because we're all immigrants. How, I guess, has being first generation impacted you as a person and like how you see the world, and especially with like how we talked about, you know, like parental sacrifices that they made for us, and like, I guess, in accordance to mental health, because I'm sure there's a lot of things that we internalize growing up in like a first gen Asian household.
So I feel like being first gen has impacted me as a person very deeply without even me realizing it, because I feel like when you're raised by like immigrant parents, their culture is so potent with who they are, and the household they raise you in is based off of the pureness of that culture. But at the same time, as soon as you step out into your school or like your environment with people your age, that's when you really start to see like a lot of different cultures happening. American culture, for me, like I was raised around a lot of Indian people. So like they have their own culture as well. And like you're kind of in this weird, I feel like everyone that grew up with immigrant parents have this sense of like observing others and analyzing, because we're trying to figure out like what's normal. And so like by doing that, we are like comparing ourselves to them and their experience and trying to figure out what's normal, what's something that's happening to me that I like or don't like, and what's something that I wish was different. And so I feel like a lot of my life was just about, you know, watching a lot of other people and being like, is what I'm going through at home normal, or is it not okay? And I think it wasn't until I was branching out more, like in high school or like college or whatever, where I started to like make connections of like what was normal and what was not normal, and like what has really deeply impacted me and hurt me, and like that it wasn't okay. And so I felt like I was always trying to like find my identity also outside of my culture, because I feel like within my culture, I'm Taiwanese, I feel like it's very conservative. Like the way women are taught to operate and serve others and present themselves is very specific. And I think for some women, it was harder to fit into those molds. For me specifically, like I physically don't fit into those molds. Like I'm a lot bigger and stronger than what is perceived as like typical Asian beauty. I'm a little bit darker. And also just like my personality was very expressive and almost like boyish, like masculine. Mm-hmm. And so like growing up, my mom would ridicule me for those traits, but like in American culture, it's seen as something good, because I feel like American culture is very like go out and get it and more aggressive in that way, I guess. Whereas Asian culture is more subdued and like non-aggressive. So I felt like my life was very much so about trying to find who I was and what I liked about myself outside of all these different like cultural differences, because there's things about American culture that I don't really like either. And there's stuff about Asian culture that I didn't really like, but just finding like who I was outside of that. What was like the other question you asked? Oh, mental health.
Yeah, like just how it relates, you know, to mental health. I think you touched upon like a lot of good things already, and definitely like with beauty standards, like I was like nodding in agreement because it's so true. Yeah. I didn't grow up in the U.S. So Summer and I both came here when we were 16, but I think growing up in Hong Kong and having those beauties, it's so hard because I always tell people this, like trends in Hong Kong, I guess, specifically, because it's so small, it's such a dense city. Like, when a trend starts, everyone just follows that same trend.
Yeah.
And if you have something out of the norm of the trend, you're labeled as, like, weird, or you're labeled as a specific stereotype, which is very unhealthy. And even, like, my family, like, I see so many TikToks about this, but it's so true that, like, how whenever you just, like, you know, want to talk, like, figure out if you've lost weight, gain weight, you just literally go see a family member and they'll be like,
yeah,
wow, like they'll comment on your body type and stuff, which definitely was very, very toxic for me growing up as well. And I think these ideas are so ingrained. I mean, some of them are also pretty racist too, with like being more tan. Like I definitely grew up like more tan than like the standard beauty, like, you know, people like fair skin and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it definitely goes back, like, in history of, like, how people would bleach their skin and stuff, like, in the past to, like, make themselves look more white. And definitely another step, you know, of them wanting to reach whiteness, I guess. But it, yeah, I, like, also, like, had a really toxic relationship with body image, where, like, and everyone around me would be the same. Like, all my friends would, like, also talk about body image in, yeah, a way that was like really toxic. Even now, like when I go home and visit and see my friends, a lot of them are very obsessed with like asking me, oh, did I get skinnier or whatever. And I rarely comment, because I'm like, that's just very unhealthy. And in high school, I actually like tried to take like cold water baths, because somebody told me it would help me lose fat. It was just so bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just that environment, yeah, really, yeah. Yeah, that was a whole tangent.
No. So, like, does that impact you still to this day? Like, how did you unpack it to a point where you're, like, trying not to feed into it in the ways that you may have growing up?
I think coming to the U.S., like, I've been more accepting of my body type, because I see so many different kinds of body types here. Not everyone looks the same. And there are definitely, I mean, there is still like a beauty standard here in the U.S., but I think it's helped me become, yeah, but I think I've become more confident because nobody around me really judged me for it. Nobody ever commented on it. And I think slowly, like, I realized that the only way that I am able to, you know, be happy with my body is by accepting it. And I think that mindset just, like, kept going on, even though, like, I, like, fall back into it a lot. Like, literally, I was talking to my therapist that I, like, was very, I, like, have recently been very self-conscious with my body. So it definitely comes and goes, and I think it definitely stems from that toxic environment. Like, a lot of my family members still comment on it a lot, and I think inherently when someone tells me, oh, you look like you've lost weight, like, that makes me happy, and then I go back into that toxic cycle of, like, oh, like, if I've gained a little weight, like, that's bad. It's just, like, it's a very hard, like, conscious and learning of what we grew up with. Comes and goes.
I feel like it's always gonna be a journey of battling the values that we're taught growing up, and then just realizing, like, our self-worth in that journey. But yeah, I definitely agree, like, with a lot of what Crystal said. I feel like especially when I first came to the US, I was having a hard time just to balance between Eastern beauty standard and Western beauty standard, because I feel like there are a lot of, like, conflicting values between the two. I talked about this in previous podcasts. It's so interesting. So when I left Hong Kong, one of the gifts that my friend gave me was, like, a bunch of bras with, like, different sizes that don't even fit me now. But then it was just a joke. But then the reason behind that gift was because, oh, they're like, oh, you're gonna get bigger boobs when you go to America, because, like, you know, the American beauty standard, like, women's body are, like, fuller, and they have, like, I guess, big boobs and big butts. So coming here, I feel like there's this pressure that, oh, like, do I need to fit into that, like, Western beauty standard? And then a little after that, I also got into a very, like, toxic, not an actual relationship with a guy, but then was a guy who was telling me to gain weight because I look too skinny, and he would not, like, be with me if I'm not at that weight. And I feel like that was the point where I built a very, like, unhealthy relationship with my own body. And yeah, and I feel like because I realized, like, I have fast metabolism and I'm never going to fit into the Western beauty standard, and that also pushed me to, like, go to the extreme of, like, the Eastern beauty standard, where I just want to slim down so badly that I don't know if it's called, like, actual eating disorder, but I was, like, so skinny at a point I was, like, 86 pounds and I was, like, 17 years old and I was, like, so skinny. And then I remember, so I will always also just think about, like, I don't want my friend, when I go back to Hong Kong, I don't want my friend to see me as, like, I don't want them to call me fat. So in the US, I need to, like, keep being slim. So when I go back, like, they won't, like, talk about how my body has changed. And then eventually, until college, I kind of got, like, freshman 15. People said freshman 15, right? I gained, like, a little more weight. I would say it's still, like, healthy weight. I was around 100 something pounds. But then in my friends and my family eyes, when I went back to Hong Kong and, like, visit my friends and family, they're like, oh my gosh, you gained so much weight. And literally, like, the first thing that my dad said to me in the airport, and we haven't seen each other in person for, like, more than a year, and then the first thing that he said to me was, oh, your face got rounder. And I was like, oh my gosh, what? I think that trip really kind of triggered me again. I'm like, I don't want to, like, I want to slim down again. And I feel like also the whole, like, relationship with food, I don't know if I've told Crystal, but that was the reason why I became vegetarian too, because I wanted to eat healthier. So yeah, I just feel like it's always going to be a battle between, you know, finding your self-worth while the society is telling you a lot about what body image you should be. Mm-hmm. But also, I also have a question. So, like, I talk about I have difficulties balancing between Eastern and Western beauty standard. Like, does that ever, like, happen to you? And how do you kind of balance between the two?
I feel like now I don't really struggle with that anymore so much as when I was younger. Because I think when I was younger, I was surrounded by more Asians, because that's like what my parents were comfortable with, obviously. So I was in a lot of, you know, either school or hobbies that required or had a lot of other Asians there. So it was a lot easier to compare yourself to them. And so that's when I really struggled, because like I feel like the way I look and the way my body's built is like, even if I tried really hard, I wouldn't fit the standard at all. Like, I wouldn't even come close. And so as I got older, I started consciously distancing myself from Asian community more. And I started hanging out with more people from different ethnic groups. So like white people, Hispanic people, you know, just trying to like figure out what are identity traits that I resonate more with and what's something I could more easily fit into without feeling like being different is something to be ashamed of. And so, yeah, so I really like try to branch out and hang out with different ethnic groups like Filipinos, Hispanics, and whites. And I think that's helped me a lot with like trying to figure out who I was, because you're surrounded by so many different types of people. And so you start seeing traits as being just different rather than something that's should be ashamed of. I think once you start to like really pinhole yourself into one community, that's when you start to lose your individuality and start feeling insecure about your unique traits. And for some people, like those traits are a lot less controllable than others. So yeah, that's something I consciously did. I feel like I'm very cognizant about who I surround myself by. And I make sure that I'm surrounded by a lot of different people all the time, just so I don't start falling into these, you know, feelings of like, I'm different. And that's something I'm insecure about because of, you know, everyone else is the same. Does that answer your question?
No, yeah. I think that's really important to like branch out your own groups. And I really agree with what you said about like when you know different types of people, you start realizing that people are just different. It's not that you're weird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's so true. I think mm-hmm. that what you just said just reminded me of how like when I was in Hong Kong, I never really was proud of being like Chinese because everyone was Chinese. But then I think
yeah.
leaving that and coming to the U.S. helped me resonate a lot more with, you know, my Hong Kong identity and being proud of that. And really, I think that's also why, like, I wanted to start this podcast, because this identity is very important to me that I never really, like, valued until I wasn't in,
yeah.
like, the group or what was seen as the norm. But yeah, I mean, like, the growing up in an Asian, you know, household with those beauty standards are so, like, I don't know, they affect you for a long time. And, I mean, even with, like, other, like, Asian household values, too, like, what I just also talked about before of, like, how do you, I guess this is a question, how do you draw the line between, you know, being respectful and, I guess, discipline and being, you know, a good kid, a good daughter to your parents, versus like recognizing, oh, this is actually unhealthy, this is toxic, and this is abuse. Because I feel like a lot of people at a young age, like if you grow up in that culture, you don't really understand, you know, the difference between discipline and abuse. And usually when you're older, then you start reflecting on those, you know, traumas, then you kind of figure it out. But it's hard to recognize it, like, as a kid, you know, like, not knowing everything you know now. I guess, like, my question is how, like, did you, to both of you, I guess, did you guys recognize that, or did you guys experience that growing up, and how do you draw that line? Like, how do you differentiate that?
For me personally, I feel like it's easy. I feel like it's easy for everyone to know what's right and what's wrong, because when it happens to you, your body's reaction of like feeling scared or sad or like any negative emotions, it's like a good indicator that something doesn't feel right. I think why we get confused is because when we express it to our parents, that's when they start to try to gaslight and explain why it's okay or why they do it. And that's when we start to get confused, because everything we learn growing up is based off of our parents. They're like our main teachers, our main guidances. So for me, like I've always known that the things they were doing to me were wrong. It's just like I didn't find a voice to say anything and speak up until later, like as a teenager, because you're like a little bit more rebellious, I guess. And like starting to, I feel like when you're a teenager, when you're a kid, you start to notice that they do certain things. But as a teenager, that's when you're really switching your brain on and you're like, okay, are they going to do the same thing they always do? And then once your parents do those things, that's when you start to get really frustrated, because you're like, you're starting to see like a pattern there. And like, especially with all the hormones, you're more brave to like say something about it. And so I started speaking up as a teenager, especially regarding towards like my mom and like body image, because I felt like I could not do anything or wear anything without her saying something about it. And it's always negative. And so I started saying things like, I would appreciate it if you stopped commenting on my body and the stuff that I ate, because it hurts my feelings and it makes me feel very sad about who I am as a person. And I don't think you want me to hate myself, but that's something that's starting to happen, is I'm starting to hate myself. And then I think something very interesting that I saw in my mom was that she would defend herself, but she would also be able to, I could see like that flip kind of switching where her programming is starting to get challenged. And she's starting to be like, she would defend herself, but I could tell she wasn't believing in what she was saying, if that made sense.
Mm.
And eventually I think, after many years of me saying that over and over and over again, she finally got to a point where she stopped commenting on things. Every now and then she'll still say something, but I think I learned to just block it out at this point, because it's like, it's not valid. Like, I'm going to determine whether or not I'm happy with my body. That's it. Like, I don't need to hear her say that. And like, I think sometimes too, what can help is like flipping it back onto your mother or parent and just be like, you know, do you say these things because you hold yourself to the same standard? If that's the case, I don't want you to be that miserable. I don't want you to be at your age and worry about how you look the way that you worry about how I look. I want you to be happy with your body as well, and just not have these crazy standards and be so concerned with how your body looks or how your skin looks or whatever. Because a lot of the times, like, it's a projection of what's inside. Like, my mom's very insecure about her body, you know? She can't wear, in her mind, she can't wear a lot of clothes. And I see that, and I'm like, she's literally projecting her own insecurities onto me, you know? And so, like, having a little bit of empathy on that end. And I think sometimes flipping it onto them is, like, a good way to get them to think. Obviously, some parents might not react well to it. But if that's the only way for them to empathize and just be like, I want you to love yourself. I don't want you to like not wear clothes because you think you're going to be ugly in it. Like, I want you to eat as much as you want until you're satisfied and not starve yourself. And like, I think for them, it's important as well to hear that, because I don't think they were ever able to hear it. And that's just another part of the journey of, you know, being an Asian American, is like a lot of the times we are kind of the therapist because we have two cultures in us. So we're able to like have two ways of thinking, I guess.
Yeah, that made me think of like probably our parents growing up in their generation. Like, they had even like stricter and more like toxic beauty standards than we did. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I agree with like maybe flipping onto them will help them like really put themselves in our shoes too. But I'm wondering, like, sometimes for me, like, personally, I'm not like a super outspoken person, especially to my parents. Yeah, like, where do you get the courage to like flip on them?
I think it stemmed from anger originally. I feel like in many ways I had to raise myself, so I developed this mentality of like, if I raise myself, then I'm allowed to stand up for myself and I'm allowed to voice my you know, feelings and concerns because they have lost that right for me to hold back when it came to communicating. And so in the beginning, it was like out of rebellion and anger, and the way I would express myself was very aggressive and hateful. But mm-hmm. as I got older and I started to heal myself more and mature, I feel like you really come to a point where you realize, like, I am my own person. I am an adult. Like, I have the right to voice anything to anyone, including my parents. And I think that's just something that you have to accept. And I think a lot of people have a hard time accepting it because they live their whole lives thinking their lives are for their parents. So they don't even mm-hmm. see themselves as their own individual. They see themselves as like a vessel for their parents, which is not necessarily good.
Yeah.
That's so true.
That's so true. Like, even in, I guess, Hong Kong specifically, because just speaking from experience, like, I know, like, Hong Kong follows, like, a very residual welfare model, which means, like, the government, like, in terms of, like, elderly care, there's not much social welfare for elderly. And, like, because in our culture, like, the government, I guess, expects the kids to take care of their parents. And so, like, even me, my parents are both in Hong Kong, and so me being here in the U.S., and they're a bit older, they had me, like, later, my relatives who are in the U.S., when I would see them, they would be like, oh, like, you know, ask me about my future plans, and are you going to go back to Hong Kong? And they'd be like, but your parents are getting older, you should take care of them, and you should, you know, be there for them. And I think it's not just within my family, it's like the whole of Hong Kong, everyone has the same beliefs. And like, if you don't take care of your parents when they're old, then that makes you a bad daughter. And I think I see that from every single person I talk to from home, like even my friends. Like, sometimes when they would be like, what are your, you know, do you plan to come back or do you plan to stay in the US? And I'm like, I don't know, still thinking about it. And they'd be like, oh, but your parents aren't here. Like, don't you want to spend more time with them? So it's like a constant guilt trip of the expectation that I need to, you know, take care of them. And I know that, like, my parents are very accepting and very, like, they don't expect me to come back and take care of them. But then now I feel like I have to, because even the system is telling me to do so, or else you're not, you know, a good daughter. And I think the system is forcing you to do so because what happens when they're old and no one's there to take care of them? Like, there's we don't have any that good of, like, elderly care in Hong Kong. So it's just like, I don't know, constant just battle in my head of like, am I a bad daughter if I choose to stay here? Because I do like the version of me here a lot, and I do have a lot of established friendships and things. Like, I'm very motivated to, you know, do my own thing here, versus when I was in Hong Kong, I was very, like, depressed, and I was very much in a slump. So this is definitely a healthier space for me, but it's just, like, me, do I pause my life and go take care of my parents and then live my life by the time, I don't know, that's, like, a very unhealthy mindset, because it's, like, you can't live your life according to their life. But then I know if I say this to my friends or my family in Hong Kong, they'd be like, that's disrespectful. So I think I'm still trying to accept that for myself. I think my parents don't mind, but I think I do. Like, it's very ingrained in me. It's hard.
What I have to say to that is, the way I see it is honestly very simple. When you're on an airplane, they tell you, if you have a kid next to you, you got to put the mask on yourself before you put it on them. Because if you can't take care of yourself and you die or pass out, then who's going to put the mask on the kid? You can't, you're both going to die. And I think when it comes to taking care of your parents, like, yes, that should be a goal for everyone, especially like immigrant, like kids of immigrants. But like, you have to make sure that you're on your feet before you could take care of them. Because if you're just not even on your feet yet, and you keep going back and forth trying to take care of them, you're just going to be struggling, and then therefore they're going to struggle, and you can't take care of them at the best capacity, and it's just not going to be a good situation for anyone. So I feel like, you know, your youth, like, you know, from 20 to maybe 35, it should just be like you, your growth, fostering who you are, your strength outside of like your family, And I feel like taking care of your parents should not be something you should have to necessarily like anxiously think about until you've like established yourself and like can objectively take care of them, both like financially, physically, whatever. And like so much can change by that time. Who knows? Like you can't predict, right? Like, what if you're 35 and you're like, I would be so down to move back to Hong Kong, or maybe your parents want to move here, you know? But life is very unpredictable, so there's no use in like trying to think of how things are going to turn out. Just like focus on your happiness now, what you want to achieve, and just like pour yourself into that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's there's a misconception, I think, a lot of times where you need to sacrifice your happiness for your parents. And I think maintaining that balance is, I guess a lot of us struggle with that. Yeah, unlearning.
Yeah. I think even now, like, even though my parents are here, like, when I'm looking for jobs, like, I'm still, like, debating if it's okay for me to go to LA or even go to New York because, well, my parents are here and I'm, like, almost the only, well, we have some relatives and families here, but not as many as we do in Hong Kong. So, like, I'm one of the people that they can really rely on to, well, I mean, I can't provide for them yet, but, you know, so I'm always just struggling, like, is it okay for me to, like, move away and have a job somewhere else, or should I be staying here until, I don't know, I think my parents are gonna go back to Hong Kong. Like, is it okay, do I need to pause my life right now until they go back to Hong Kong and I stay here?
I think the root of that is that our parents want to know that we're going to love them, take care of them, and not abandon them. And I think if you're able to address that and say, I love you, I want to take care of you, but in order for me to get there, I have to do this first. I think the way you frame that is very important, because sometimes, especially like immigrant parents, I feel like they're very black and white, like simple-minded. Because like that's what it took for them to come and create a life here and all that stuff. But like when you're able to like really directly talk about the root of something rather than just saying what you want to do, it's easier for them to understand. Because if you're like, I want to go to New York, there's a really great opportunity here, I feel like I could really flourish, all they hear is like, I'm leaving you and I'm gonna abandon you. So if you're able to just like address that one thing right away and say, I love you, I'm not abandoning you, this is actually what I need to do in order to take care of you, you know, I think it's easier for them to like grasp that in that sort of sense.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, like, just fun fact, I still haven't said I love you in Kanto to my parents. Well, at least maybe when I was a kid.
I don't. Yeah.
I haven't said I love you either.
Me?
Oh my god.
That's so funny. I feel like it's just not. It's just so weird. And yeah. I think definitely quality time and acts of service is how I show love. That's why I think I prioritize spending time with them like so excessively whenever I'm in Hong Kong, because I'm like, this is how I show love, and I hope you understand.
Yeah, that's just so true. Okay, so now we kind of want to move on to like the next topic. So we were able to watch your YouTube video, and I remember in one of your YouTube video you talk about being in a narcissistic abusive relationship. So even I myself, I don't think I've been in an abusive relationship. I still relate to a lot of the things that you said in terms of like how I behave or how I feel when I'm in a relationship. So I'm wondering, do you think some of the Asian values and expectations affected your relationships? And not only romantically, it can also be like just friendships too.
Yes. I think this is not just in Asian cultures. I think this is just overall a female experience, because I think women are taught throughout all cultures to serve someone else, mainly the man, especially within relationships. And if that's something that's taught to us at a young age and something that is perpetuated through expectations from our own family and parents, then once you find yourself in unbalanced, you know, relationships, toxic relationships, or abusive relationships, it's a lot easier for you to become a victim because you're used to, you know, being the subservient person, always doing things for the other person and not voicing what you need and your concerns. Yeah. I honestly think that that's something is very common within women in general. And I definitely think there's like a movement now where women are a lot more open about their experiences and what should be, like, what's the healthy way of being in a relationship and what you should be asking for. So in that sense, I'm very encouraged by that. But I think especially in Asian culture, it's like even more perpetuated just because we're taught to not really like voice when we're uncomfortable with something. And I mean, everyone's kind of just quiet in Asian culture in general, not just the woman, but the men as well. And so like growing up, like my parents were the type where like if our food tasted bad, they would just eat it anyways, instead of telling the waiter like, oh, this was not cooked right. Very much so like that, like kind of like suffer in silence type of a thing. And I think if men are like that in our culture, women are going to be even worse. So I definitely think that's like a whole reason why I think Asian women are also fetishized in the US, because of that fact of like, you know, being subservient, you know, men being able to dominate them more and all that stuff. But like, yeah, that's just like a very summarized, like my opinion on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like definitely with sexism ingrained within Asian culture, is especially Chinese culture, is just very apparent. And I think that even in China, yes, the one child policy really, really messed up a lot. Like it's three now. The gender norm, it's three now, I know, but back in the day, like when we were born, I know that if kids were born female, like they would be sent to orphanages because the parents wanted a boy and the boy would carry on the last name. I guess that's just a huge thing within like Chinese culture, is that you want your last name to be carried on. And it's nice to me to see that nowadays, like, a lot of women want to keep their last names and like hyphenate or like not change it.
I already talked to my partner about how if we ever got married, like, I'm keeping my last name, and if we ever have kids, they're gonna have my last name.
Yes. I love that.
I'm carrying that child in my stomach. I'm ruining my body and I'm giving birth to it. So like, why should it have just your last name? Like, he could put his last name there, but my last name is going to be the main last name.
Yes. Yes. I know. I feel that. I'm like, we either hyphenate. The child is not just taking your last name.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad like this has become more common in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's still like not, I don't think it's a thing in Hong Kong. I don't know about like other Asian culture, but still.
I think you're just expected to
have
your dad's last name.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it socially, the US is like a melting pot of like so many cultures. I feel like because of that, there's bound to be a lot of questioning of like what's working and what's not working. But if you go to countries where everyone's kind of on the same page and kind of exhibiting the same morals and behavior patterns, it's harder to break out of that because it's like you have nothing to latch on to. And if you try to be different, it's a lot more obvious. And so you're going to be like more segregated. So I think like, if you're going to like look at it in that way, like socially, I think countries that all have the same type of ethnicity and like general like social constructs, it's like harder for them. It's going to be like a slower progression of like moving out of these than like the US, for example.
Definitely. So I guess to end, what kind of like how do you think we can unlearn all those toxic values and expectations passed down, and how can we reparent ourselves? Like you were saying that you kind of had to do that for yourself, too. And, you know, not repeat the same patterns and not pass down the same attributes to our future?
Honestly, it just starts with self-awareness, like getting to know yourself and your patterns, both like behaviorally and like cognitively, like, you know, being aware of how you react in certain situations, what your triggers are, you know, things that you don't have to think about, but you automatically just do. Start to challenge yourself with replacing those thought patterns or behavior patterns. Like catching yourself in moments where you're normally going to react with a lot of anxious thinking and like spiraling and being like, okay, I'm spiraling because I'm used to having my parents be that voice that's telling me how everything's going to go wrong and how there's so many ways things can go wrong. And like recognizing where it comes from and being like, okay, I'm in a new phase in my life where I could just calm down and not have to spiral and like be reasonable and say like, if it's going to work out, it's going to work out. If not, that's fine as well, you know? And that's the whole process of reparenting. That's why people say it's so tiring, because you're literally changing everything about yourself. And it's a lot of work. And I think a lot of people need help with that, which is totally valid and fine as well, which is why there's therapy and there's, you know, coaching. Is some people need someone to be there to analyze them and facilitate that growth and that transformation. So I would say awareness is the first step, honestly.
Mm-hmm. And even with like therapy and coaching, I feel like explaining that to like the generation above us is just like very interesting, because even now when I tell, because I go to therapy, and even when I tell my mom that, she's like, oh, what did you, you know, what's wrong this week? Like, what did you talk to the therapist about? And she kind of like hints at it, and she's like, is everything okay? And I think she thinks I'm like, I don't know, like in a really bad spot. But I'm just like, mom, I'm literally just like processing my feelings with this unbiased person. It's just funny. She asks me every time on the phone, and I just don't know how to explain it to her.
My dad thinks it's like a hospital visit. He's like, are you okay now? Are you fine? Like, as if like I go to therapy and they put a band-aid or like stitch me up, and then he thinks that it should be over after a few sessions or something. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh God. Yeah.
It'd be like that. Well, I guess to close again, we wanted to ask you like a lighthearted question, just because.
Yeah.
This is really productive conversation, but on the topic of mental health, what is your favorite self-care activity?
Breathing. I think people forget like the power of breath. And a lot of the times when we feel a lot of anxiety start to build up in our bodies, you could feel that tenseness, and then you could feel your chest being really tight. And we think that we should do all these things to like make it better. Whether it's like medicine, pills, working out or whatever. But honestly, like all it takes is like breathing, and like breathe in through your nose and just like hold it in your stomach. And that whole process will literally like calm you down so much. Like there's a reason why when people cry, they start to breathe really fast. It's because your body's trying to like calm you down. And so, yeah, that's my number one. Like anytime I'm starting to feel any anxiety, I just like breathe in really deeply through my nose, and it helps every single time.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
I always forget to breathe. Mm-hmm. My Apple Watch is like, it's time to breathe. And I'm like,
dismiss. Wait, they can tell you that?
Yeah. I think it's the default setting. They can tell you that, but they remind you to breathe because they can track you, I guess.
Wow, I don't have Apple, so I didn't know. Wow. But yeah, I love that. I love that.
What's your summer? Very
mine, I think... Right now, mine is like making jewelry. You know how I'm like making jewelry with like the beads? It's just very brainless and also relaxing. And I just like have something to focus on while I'm making something beautiful. And it makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm. That's good. How about you, Crystal?
Yeah.
I think editing photos is really therapeutic for me. Or canceling plans.
Yes.
I don't know. I just, like, sometimes when it stresses me out, and I'm, like, I just need to take time for myself, and then I have that alone time. It's just really healing. Yeah. Yeah, I think those two really help. But yeah, that's it. Wow. That's it for our episode. Thank you so much to Irene for being here and talking to us. And oh, if people want to find you, where can they find you?
Okay, so I have a few platforms. My Instagram is self_embark. Mm-hmm. And then my TikTok, I believe, is Irene_self_embark.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the other way around. Okay.
Yeah, it's Irene_self_embark. And then what is my YouTube? Oh, it's just Irene just C. Like your...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, just your name. Okay.
That's my name, Irene C. Yeah.
And if you're listening.
That's where I mainly post on my Instagram. I post a lot of mental health stuff on there that I make myself. And then also my TikTok, I post on there as well, where I talk more about my experiences, or just more detailed things about, I guess, things people may go through with mental health and all that stuff. I try to focus more on the experience of an Asian American, but yeah.
I think we really need that.
Mm-hmm. We really do.
All right. Cool. It was such a good episode.
Mm-hmm. Really? That's good. It was nice talking to you guys today and meeting you guys.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Okay, I guess that's it. That's the end.
Outro music.